And it's usually true. This time it's true. Good preachers are appreciative of flexible song leaders for all kinds of reasons. All right, 1 Corinthians chapter 15. If you haven't already turned there, you might do so. You're not going to be surprised what you find there. 1 Corinthians 15 is a relatively frequent place to turn as far as my preaching goes and preachers that I've known in the past. Generally speaking, people turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 15 for one of two reasons. To discuss the resurrection of the Lord, and really our own resurrection and all the implications of the theories, or not theories, but doctrines of the resurrection. Or to talk about verse 33. Everything else in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 is referring either primarily or secondarily to the resurrection. The first section there where the Apostle Paul is basically boiling down the gospel to its core elements is doing so for the purpose of emphasizing how important the resurrection is. The very last verse, which we also sometimes quote out of context, where we're told, therefore be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. The reason that we're supposed to do that is with consideration of the resurrection, which is going to come in the future to reward those who have been faithful. Verse 33 is an outlier. And those of you who have heard me preach and teach for the last 5 years know how fanatical I am on the subject of context. Context comes up all the time. The best way to understand a part of a verse is to understand the rest of the verse. The best way to understand part of a chapter is by understanding the rest of the chapter. The best way to understand part of a book is by understanding the rest of the book. And the best, you get the idea. And I would suggest that the best way to understand verse 33 is to understand 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Sometimes I refer to a general principle that's placed in a specific context. So that's what I would call 1 Corinthians 15, verse 33. The Apostle Paul is evidently quoting from something, some kind of adage. It's not exactly clear what that is. It doesn't appear to be any kind of specific reference to a Bible verse as far as I can tell. It's a proverb, you might say. And we all know what it says. And we quote it in various ways. Evil companionships corrupt good morals, or bad company corrupts good manners, or along those lines. And all the teenagers know this verse very well, right? Because the parents who are trying to teach their children memory verses are looking for verses that are A, nice and short, and B, very, very relevant to the lives of young people, right? And so we grab 1 Corinthians 15, 33. Pick good friends. You know, you pick good friends and they're going to get you on drugs and they're going to get you involved in gangs and all of these kind of things, which very well may be true. And I think that's an appropriate use of the passage. I've used it that way and I'll continue to use it that way. But what I would like to do for a little bit here this evening is to look at the actual context and talk about what the actual bad company is that we're talking about here and what the good morals are that we supposedly have, that we're supposed to have, and that hopefully we'll be able to keep despite the efforts of the bad company. So that's basically how the lesson's going to go. Before we do that, I like to do one of my favorite things, and that is to define terms. Some terms which may be relatively obvious under normal circumstances, but maybe a little bit different here. The word bad, of course, is that which is not good. You know that, right? Good things are good out of their nature. Bad things are the ones that don't have the bad. It's kind of like darkness. Darkness is defined by a lack of light. Badness is defined by a lack of goodness. The bad fruit grows on the bad tree. That's how you know it's the bad tree. It's a bad tree that doesn't have the good fruit. And that's what a bad thing is. And it's important to even emphasize these minor things here, because how many times have we talked about a friend or an association or a doctrine or whatever? Well, it's not all that bad. And I think what we mean by that, well, let's take churches. There are churches in this town where you could probably go and hear a preacher, kind of like me, who would speak for, whatever, half an hour, 45 minutes, and not say anything that you might consider to be bad. And so, therefore, he must be good because he didn't do anything that was bad. Well, in a sense, yes, perhaps. And perhaps there is. I'm sure there are very good preachers in here. But just because...
doesn't have anything bad, inherently bad, doesn't necessarily mean that it's good. Sometimes bad is basically just the absence of good things. You can have a teacher who doesn't necessarily teach anything that's wrong. Doesn't ever contradict the Bible. He can go months without saying anything that's contradictory to Bible teachings and yet be a bad teacher because he doesn't have enough good things or the most important good things in his teaching. God is going to define good. It is, in fact, defined by God himself. Luke 17, verse 19, Jesus. I'm getting on the story right in a second. Jesus confronting the rich young ruler there. Why do you call me good? No one is good except God. And his point there, of course, is that absolute goodness can only be seen in God. And if you're calling Jesus absolutely good, there must be some reflection of God in him in that situation. And so, therefore, we're defining bad things as things that do not have a proper quantity of good things, not just things that are evil. And we say that because we're going to get to these bad associations in a little bit. A company, I'm defining that as association by choice. The company you keep, we talk about. Well, when you get out in the car tomorrow morning, unless you get a five-day weekend, good for you. If you do, if you get in the car tomorrow and you're going into traffic, you're surrounded by people who are not of your choosing, right? And probably some of them are going to turn out to be knotheads, right? And they're going to be obnoxious and they're going to have annoying things on their bumper stickers and all that sort of thing. You don't have any control over that. That's not the bad company we're talking about in this context. The bad company that we're talking about is the company that we choose for ourselves. You know, if some solicitor comes trying to sell you, you know, encyclopedias or a new water filtration system or, you know, whatever it happens to be they're selling these days, he comes and knocks on your door, and he happens to get half a foot in your door or whatever before you try to cut it off. That person is not company, right? The company is the people that you invite, or sometimes invite themselves, and you have them into your home, and you're more or less glad to have them, right? That's the company that you have. Not the guy who intrudes on you here. The company that we're keeping is association by choice. 2 Corinthians 6 and verse number 14 talks about do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. That yoking, that joining together, it's a similar concept that we're talking about there. The people that you choose to attach yourself to in one context or another. Some association is going to be inevitable. We're living in an evil world. It's not just out there in traffic. It's at the job site. It's at school. It's everywhere. The people that you happen to be in close proximity to, physical proximity, at some point in your day, you have limited amount of control over that. What we want to do is exercise whatever control we can exercise, particularly with regard to the people that we welcome into our lives. Not just into our physical company, but into our emotional, our spiritual, our mental company, as it were. And a word or two about the morals here. This is an interesting word in the Greek. The word that we have translated morals or manners in this context does not appear anywhere else in the Bible. It is related to a word that is found in a verse that we refer to a lot, or in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 25, where it says we're supposed to not forsake the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, or the custom of some. Very similar word, related a word. We're not talking here about slips in judgment. We're not talking about individual actions. We're talking about a course of behavior that you've chosen for yourself. Now, the implication is here that you as Christians, as readers of 1 Corinthians chapter 15, have good morals. You have good manners, as it were. You have developed certain good habits that you are in as Christians, and that's a good thing. You should be pleased about that. We're all pleased for you. That is a blessing to be able to have these good habits to fall into, as it were. However, we need to understand, as Christians, that these habits can be unlearned. Just like you unlearned all your bad habits when you came into Jesus. If you're not careful, you can unlearn your good habits. And the best way to do that is by intentionally surrounding yourself with bad people. By inviting into your company
people who do not share your values, who do not share your philosophy of life, who do not share your appreciation for the doctrine of Jesus Christ. The closer you allow those people into your life, the more damage they are likely to do. That's basically what we're talking about here in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 33. Okay, so let's be specific about this. Let's first of all talk about bad teaching, because that's the immediate context here. The people in Corinth, the Christians in Corinth, have been exposed to doctrines regarding the resurrection occurring. That the resurrection has already occurred. And Paul expects them to be continually exposed to this. This doctrine has not died, by the way. There are people who maintain today in the Lord's church, for practical purposes, the resurrection has already occurred. One of these days I'll have an actual discussion and have somebody try to defend that point of view. That seems so completely contrary to the New Testament. I have difficulty wrapping my mind around that. But that's for another subject, for another day. When we put our confidence in these bad teachers, we set ourselves up for failure. We set ourselves up for disaster. It's important that every teacher, including this teacher, is examined by you, the listener, by you, the student, by the Word of God. Paul says of himself, as an apostle of Jesus Christ, as one who is directly inspired by the gospel, by the Holy Spirit, be imitators of me as I imitate Christ. Now, he's not saying they're just that. Be an imitator of me because I have determined that I need to imitate Christ, and that's a good thing, and that you need to model yourself after me. I'm sure that's part of it. But there's also a sense of qualification that is placed in there. Yes, you need to be a follower of me, but it may be, and truthfully speaking, will be, at some point in my life, a situation where I will not be imitating Christ. Don't imitate that. Imitate me while I am imitating Christ. You might paraphrase it in that way and not get too far from the original meaning. All of us could and should say the same thing to our neighbors. You ought to imitate me because I'm imitating Christ. And when the day comes that I'm not imitating Christ, just turn the motor off, as it were. We're not going to imitate that. We're only truly imitating Jesus in our lives. That's what good teachers are trying to do. The bad teachers, consciously or unconsciously, are trying to take you in a different direction. Paul has this struggle constantly. And it's kind of a head scratcher. You would like to think that the Apostle Paul would not have trouble maintaining his credibility with his audience. He's the Apostle Paul. He's world famous. He's directly powered by the Holy Spirit. We would certainly think, anyway, that a man like this would not need to flash his credentials all the time. And yet we find Paul doing exactly that over and over again, because he had his audience, most usually people that he knows well, they have been exposed to people who opposed Paul, directly or indirectly, opposed Paul. And they came with their own set of qualifications. They came with their own criteria for what makes a good teacher and that sort of thing. And oftentimes, for whatever reason, maybe they were just better speakers than Paul was. Or maybe they were the ones who were there and Paul wasn't there. You know, whatever the reason happens to be, they followed after him. And Paul says, you need to reserve your fellowship for those who are teaching you the truth. And, well, how do we know which one's teaching the truth? Well, that's why you examine them. You examine them very carefully. You check references. You check scriptures. You check teachings. You check track records. In our modern society, it's relatively easy to do this. It's not too difficult to get on Google or you know, whatever kind of search engine you want and find out information about a human being. And if you want to find out about a teacher, you can find out his philosophy fairly well by looking at the things that are posted articles that he's written and sermons that he preached and such and such. You did some of that before I came here. When I was, 5.5 years ago. Many of you did a great deal of background work on me. I expected you to do that. I didn't resent that in the slightest. I've been a little upset if you hadn't done that. That's a good thing. You reserve your fellowship for the people who are teaching you the truth. Well, why wouldn't you do that? Right? What's the most important thing about a teacher? He teaches you the truth, right? Well, what if a teacher doesn't teach you the truth? Well, he's a nice guy, and you know he's got a lot of good qualities. Maybe we'll just keep him around anyway. The Apostle Paul, when he says in Galatians 6 and verse 6, that the student is to communicate in all good things with the teacher, the one who's teaching the truth. He's talking about fellowship there. He's talking about a spiritual association far more than he is carnal, material association. That's used a lot of times to defend the idea of preachers being paid. Now, I don't think that's the point at all. What he's saying there is that you got these false teachers out there that you have spiritual association with, and you have me, the one who taught you the truth initially, the one who's still teaching you the truth, and for whatever reason you cut off contact with me. Okay, you got this backward. You need to reverse this. Have fellowship with the one who's teaching you the truth, not with the one who's teaching you the error. And that's what we need to do in our associations. We need to trust in the ones who are teaching the truth. Some of these ones have demonstrated themselves to be unworthy. And I could call names if I wanted to. You'd recognize the names. I'm not going to do that. We can trade names in the foyer if you want to. But there are plenty of very high-profile preachers. Some not too far from us, maybe. Some of them on television or whatever. That, again, aren't necessarily famous for saying things that are wrong. Some of them are. Generally, the criticism of such ones is more that they do not stand for what is right. Is one better than the other? Is one more acceptable than the other? No, a true teacher of the truth is going to teach all of the truth and stand for all of the truth. The one who doesn't do that, the Apostle Paul says to, and the versions are going to vary, but mark such ones. Stay away from them, he says. And he goes on to say some pretty harsh words about these ones who would claim to be brethren, who claim to be teachers, and yet are not ultimately following the truth. Pay attention to such ones. Do not allow them to have their hooks into your heart and into your mind. And again, like we said before, bad is the absence of good. It's not just the presence of error. It can be the presence of error. Oftentimes it is. But sometimes the worst teachers are the ones that don't teach you anything but the truth. They just teach you part of the truth. You know, when I preach on grace, I'm hard-pressed to not preach on works at the same time. That gets a little frustrating sometimes because, you know, I go over 40 minutes and, you know, my feet start hurting and you got to go get some lunch or whatever. And I know you're going through the same thing. You know, I don't have time to preach another sermon on works today. And yet I feel compelled to talk a little bit about it most times. Because if I don't do that, someone might think that I prefer grace over works, which I don't. That's a very common problem that preachers have, the frustration. We deal with that because it's important that the things that we teach are understood in the proper context. We say the entire truth, as much as we can anyway, with the opportunities that we have. Faithful teachers are going to declare the whole purpose of God. That's what Paul says he did while he was there in Ephesus, talking to the Ephesian elders in Miletus in Acts chapter 20, verse number 27. Not just the parts that are popular. And I like the text in Isaiah chapter 30, and I refer to it from time to time just because I like language. And I like this language. If you have your Old Testament, you might flip over there and look at what Isaiah has to say about such ones, or what God has to say, really, about such ones. Isaiah is told in verse number 9 with regard to his audience, his people. For this is a rebellious people, false sons, sons who refuse to listen to the instruction of the Lord, who say to the seers, "You must not see visions." And the prophets, "You must not prophesy to us what is right. Speak to us pleasant words. Prophesy illusions. Get out of the way. Turn aside from the path. Let us hear no more about the Holy One of Israel." Now, obviously, God is not quoting anybody here. At least I don't think he is. Nor do I think that this is a literal representation of what Isaiah is hearing on a day-to-day basis, or what other prophets are hearing on a day-to-day basis. Maybe it was. I don't know. I think more likely this is a synopsis. This is a characterization. And it's not just a characterization of people who lived 700 years before Christ. It's people today who are not especially interested in hearing the bad stuff. You like hearing good news or bad news better? What, is this a good news kind of crowd? Probably so, right? Pretty much everybody likes hearing the good news, right? That's natural. If you go to the doctor, though, and he says, you know, "Well, I got good news and bad news," just like in the jokes, right? Hopefully you say, "A, knock it off, doc. You know, I'm not in the mood." And B, we're going to hear the bad news eventually. Okay, I came here to hear the bad news. We're not excited about it, but we're not going to ignore it either, because the bad news is what you really need to hear. The good news is what you want to hear. The bad news is what you need to hear. And so we listen to the bad news so that maybe we can do something about the bad news. Now, that's the way we come to the Lord. When we come to the Lord and listen to what he has to say, or what his teachers are telling us he is saying, his faithful teachers, we are very interested in hearing the good news, of course, but we also want to hear the bad news. Not because we're depressed, not because we want to be depressed, not because we're masochistic or something, but because we want to change. We want to make things right, as they may be wrong, in our life. And essentially, the one who doesn't have that attitude is saying the things that these people are saying here. I don't want to hear the truth. I just want to hear the good stuff. I just want you to sugarcoat everything. I want you to give it to me nice and easy. I don't want you to ruffle any feathers. I want you to let me leave the place feeling good about myself and satisfied with where I am in my life, and not challenge me and not push me and not anger me. Just let me live my life the way that I'm already living my life right now. A preacher can have a very long, successful career with that kind of approach. That kind of preacher doesn't get fired too often, to be perfectly blunt about it. And it's tempting sometimes for the ones who are kind of on the fence here. The ones who have the spirit of Isaiah, the spirit of Jeremiah, the spirit of Paul are going to say, well, that's very interesting that you want to hear that, but as a matter of fact, you're going to hear what you need to hear. And that's not an easy burden to bear. I cringe in those moments. I check my words about 20 times. I run outlines past Tracy. I say, is this a good idea? Is this good timing? But it's not a matter of whether error needs to be confronted. It's a matter of how. Under what circumstance? In what venue? What words should be chosen? We always have to stand for the truth, not just for the parts that people are going to like. All right, having said all that, that's the main point. But let's branch out a little bit and take it a step further. Maybe it's not a teacher that we're talking about. Maybe it's just people who are giving us advice. Which way should I go? Should I turn left? Should I turn right? There is a sort of human being, I'll just say this, who will go to a friend in need of advice, or at least saying that he or she needs advice. Let's not kid ourselves. Guys don't do this. This is a woman who's doing this. The woman asks for advice, right? Man doesn't ask for advice. So we'll just say it's a woman. And that's not an insult, ladies. That's a compliment. What can I do? What do you think I ought to do? And the person that she's going to may have an idea. And that person may voice the idea. Well, maybe you should do this. Yeah, maybe. Or you could do this other thing. Maybe. I don't know. And before too long, the person who's giving the advice realizes that the person has already decided what she's going to do. Right? They don't want help. They want vindication. They don't want to get ideas. They want to hear that their idea they've already decided on is a good idea. And if they don't get that, they get resentful. They get angry. They decide to choose more friends. And they'll go friend shopping until they find somebody who tells them what they want to hear. That's not the same thing as looking for advice. Looking for advice really is asking people who you trust, people whose values you share, what would genuinely be the best thing for me to do, and giving credit to what they say. Not necessarily doing what they say, but realizing this is valuable, and I need to respect this. There are going to be people that you run across every day of your life who will tell you what you want to hear in a situation where you've already made up your mind what to do. I would suggest that you can do better than that. And Jesus offers you better than that. That's why people don't go to Jesus. Because they know what he's going to say. He's been telling them for years. They don't want to listen to it anymore. They want to listen to something else. And so they go someplace else. One of the great things about completed revelation, the entirety of the scriptures in front of our faces, in our hands, is the knowledge that Jesus is not going to change. That the advice that he gave people 2,000 years ago is the same advice he gives us. He is called the Wonderful Counselor, among other things. We refer to Isaiah chapter 9, verses 6, 7, and 8 this morning. This is part of his character. This is part of his toolbox, if you will. When we go to him, we know which way we should go with our life. He's not just an average counselor, decent counselor, proven counselor. He's a wonderful counselor for us. And so the good advice that we receive secondhand, the advice that we receive from friends, family members, newspaper columns, whatever, whatever good advice we get, by definition, is going to harmonize with God's will for our lives. You cannot get good advice that takes you away from God. You cannot get good advice that contradicts the Bible. There's no such thing as that. You'll get lots of stuff that claims to be good advice, but it is not good advice. The Word of God is what describes itself as a lamp to our feet and a light to our pathway. And if you choose for yourself an advisor who does not rely on God's Word for the bulk of his or her wisdom, you can take it for granted that at some point, and it probably won't take very long, at some point that person is going to lead you or try to lead you in a way that is contrary to God's will for your life. You need to turn a deaf ear to that kind of advice and probably, or at least quite likely, cut off contact with that advisor. Put them in their place. That's not the kind of advice that I want here. That being said, the reason, again, that Jesus' advice is rejected so often by so many people is because Jesus has a tendency to tell us the things that we don't want to hear. We want to hear that we're wonderful. We want to hear that everything is fine. We want to hear that we don't have to change anything, and it's all their fault, and it's not our fault at all. And the bottom line is, Jesus doesn't usually say that. Jesus challenges us. Jesus tells us to quit making excuses, for instance. You know the text there in Luke chapter 14 where the man is given the big dinner and everybody has an excuse for why they don't want to come. And the quality of this excuse really isn't the point. The point is the quality of the invitation and the fact that they value whatever else is going on in their life more than the dinner and the invitation and the person who sent them the invitation. Likewise, when we have all these excuses for why we're not doing what God told us to do, and generally we have a variety, you can find somebody, if you want, who will tell you your excuse is valid. Who will tell you, oh, that's just, God doesn't want you to be unhappy. God doesn't want you to make your life miserable. God doesn't want you to uproot your life and give up all these things and hurt my feelings. And, you know, absolutely. You'll find people who tell you that. You probably won't have to look very hard. That's not what Jesus tells you. Jesus tells you the exact opposite. It's not all about you. You know? How many times, and I referred you to Philippians 2, verses 3 and 4, I don't know how many times in the last 5 years. I'll do it again. Are we supposed to think of our things? Is my opinion, my will, my preferences, my feelings, is that the preeminent important thing? Well, no. Paul says, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit. With humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. Let's be honest with ourselves here, brethren. Is there any part of that passage you don't understand? Do I really need to stand up here and clarify anything from any of this? Doesn't this pretty much speak for itself? What would you say to someone who says, well, you know, every once in a while it just needs to be about me. Every once in a while, I just feel like just shutting off my ears and quit listening to other people's problems and start focusing on my problems for a change. Very common sentiment. Very common sentiment in the church, quite frankly. But an absolute slap in the face to the Lord Jesus Christ, who never thought that way, who never made it about himself, and who requires us to have his attitude. As Paul goes on to say in the very next verse, verse 5, have this attitude in yourselves, which is also in Christ Jesus. Are we able to not make it about us? If I were to catalog the number of complaints and disputes that I have seen and to a certain degree moderated over or been involved in over the last 20 years, And if I were to make a big old list of them, names and faces and all that, and if I were to put in a side-by-side column here the number of those that ultimately were caused by selfishness, or at least made worse by selfishness, and really more to the point, would have gone away entirely if one person, only one, doesn't have to be two, one would do it. If one person would have said, you know what, I'm just more concerned about that person than I'm me. I'm going to pursue their welfare and not my own. I would venture to say at least 80%, and probably closer to 95% of those disputes would have disappeared. Just quit thinking about yourself all the time. Prioritize someone else. Sacrifice, then sacrifice some more. Are you one of those people who really likes to sacrifice, likes to give stuff up for no particular reason, just because somebody asked you to? The world's full of people like that, right?
No.
And the church isn't full of people like that either. And when Jesus asks us to give, we give because we love the Lord. And so we give, and we sure give a whole lot more than some of our brethren do. And our, you know, our neighbors out there in the world don't even talk about them. And then instead of patting us on the back, Jesus asks us to give some more. Well, I already gave. Sacrifice, continue to sacrifice. Sacrifice important things. Sacrifice relationships. Sacrifice treasured activities. Well, I really would like to do this with my life. And no, you're not going to be able to do that. Matthew chapter 16, verse number 24 and following. Then Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow after me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. I will guarantee you right now, your idea that you came up with on your own of what your life ought to be like, what you would like your life to be, the things that characterize it, things that you do, the people that you spend time with, you're going to have to sacrifice a great deal of that for the Lord. You may have to sacrifice all of it. Your favorite pastime, your best friend, the love of your life. Jesus says, my will has to come first. And repeatedly he says, the ones who are not willing to take up their cross are not worthy of me, he says. If you want to be a Christian, this is the kind of life advice you're going to get. Stop rationalizing, start obeying. Right? This is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, right? Except for the ones that are really, really tough. Except for the ones that are inconvenient, the ones that nobody else seems to be keeping. The ones that are really going to be costly or what? No. He doesn't say that. In fact, 1 John chapter 5 and verse number 3 says, the love of God is for us to keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome. You can do this. I'm aware that I just spent 3 minutes telling you how costly it was going to be. Yes, it's going to be costly. It's going to be difficult. You're going to give things up. But you can do this. You are capable. If you love the Lord, you will want to do this. So instead of digging around in the scriptures like so many people do, trying to find some kind of loophole in God's will that will allow you to do what you want to do instead of doing what you know perfectly well God's telling you to do. Instead, let's just obey. Just do what's right. Quit coming up with the excuses. Anyway, we had to get to here eventually, so let's talk about friends for a little bit before we close up. Because this is where we get a lot of the bad advice. And it's appropriate. This is why I think it's appropriate for us to go to 1 Corinthians 15, 13 and talk about companionships and friendships and schoolyard friends and things like that. Because this is where we learn how to deal with our fellow man. In our younger years, in school, at work, we're learning these social skills. And part of our need for social skills involves our need to fit in. Our need to make friends, to have alliances, people who will have our back and we have theirs. It's a natural human craving. There's no need to apologize for that. However, sometimes, for whatever reason, we choose people who are going to protect their interests and what they think that your interest should be, they are not especially interested in Jesus' interests or in your spiritual interests. Choose very carefully. And I'm not just talking to the young people here, although I am talking to the young people. I am confused by parents of teenagers who don't know their children's friends. I'm going over to so-and-so's house. Okay. Have fun. Come back whenever. Who are these people? What are their parents like? Do they have good grades? Do they do drugs? Are they in gangs? What kind of clothes do they wear? What kind of sexual habits do they have? I'm not suggesting just hire private investigators for every single person your child ever meets. Good bro doing that. But there are certain very fundamental, rudimentary investigation that you can do. And your child will not necessarily resent you for that. And maybe they will, but even so. We're protecting the people that we care about. And ultimately, our children understand that. They may act like they don't, but they understand that. The friend of Jesus is going to obey the commandments of the Lord. All right? I don't want to be friends with somebody who's not friends with the Lord. I'll be acquainted with them. I will shake hands with them. I will spend time with them. But I will not bond with them. I will not bring them into my heart and into my life at that level. There's always going to be a distance there. There needs to be a distance there. And my friend needs to know it. Because I am friends with the Lord. And if I'm going to be the friend of the Lord, I need to keep his commandments. That's what Jesus said himself in John chapter 15, verse 14. It's the love of God that we do that. Right? We just talked about that. Now, if somebody that we are vetting for a friendship turns out to be a friend of the world, turns out to be closely attached to things that we know are contrary to God's will, they openly espouse values that we reject. Their language exposes them. Their clothing exposes them. Their pastimes expose them. Generally, people will tell you what kind of person they are. They're frankly trying to tell you what kind of person they are. All you have to do is keep your eyes open, your ears open. James chapter 4, verse 4 says that the one who makes friends with the world is an enemy of God. And, you know, the friend of my enemy is my enemy. The one who is friends with the world sets himself at odds not just with the Lord, he sets himself at odds with me. For my own sake and for his, really, certainly for the Lord's sake, it is imperative that I oppose this. I don't have to be mean about it. I don't have to be rude about it. I don't necessarily have to cut off contact. But there needs to be a spiritual distance between us and our friends. Ask yourself, think about the best friend that you have in the world right now who's not a Christian. And ask yourself, does that person understand the distance between him and me? Or maybe we could be a little more honest about it. Is there a distance? Do they notice a difference between their life and my life? Do we talk about it? Does it get uncomfortable from time to time? This is what happens when we have associations with people in the world. And when we allow that friction to not exist, when we become comfortable in those situations, before too long, we are swallowed up with their lifestyle. Or at least we're dreaming about it on the way. Would a good friend undermine your faith? Would a good friend laugh at you for the choices that you're making, criticize you, question them, try to break you down? This is the job of the world. This is the devil's work here. 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 4, among other things, Peter says, in all this they, that is your friends in the world, supposed friends in the world, they are surprised that you do not run with them into the same excesses of dissipation, and they malign you. Does that remind you of high school? Remind you of college? Remind you of the way it was when your so-called friends were trying to get you to drink, trying to get you to experiment with drugs, trying to get you to be a little more flexible with your morality. This is what bad friends are going to do, not good friends. Would a good friend draw you into immoral behavior? Cause you? Entice you? Cause may be a too strong of a word. They're not going to cause you to do anything. But they'll convince you it's in your best interest. There's a great description of gang activity, is what I call it anyway, in Proverbs chapter 1. I think if you showed this to the average beat cop who deals with gang activities, yeah, that sounds about right. My son, if sinners entice you, verse 10 of chapter 1, do not consent. If they say, come with us, let us lie in wait for blood. Let us ambush the innocent without cause. Let us swallow them alive like Sheol, even whole as those who go down to the pit. We will find all kinds of precious wealth. We will fill our houses with spoil. Throw your lot in with us. We shall all have one purse. Let's go beat people up and take their stuff. It'll be great. You'll have family. You'll have people who care about you. You'll have people who are partners with you. Again, we have this craving as human beings for human association. We need it. We're desperate for it. Not just teenagers. Solomon says, my son, do not walk in the way with them. Keep your feet from their path. From their feet run to evil. For their feet run to evil, and they hasten to shed blood. Indeed, it is useless to spread the baited net in the sight of any bird, but they lie in wait for their own blood. They ambush their own lives. So are the ways of everyone who gains by violence. It takes away the life of its possessors. You know, we look at statistics for gang activity. I'm kind of focusing on that, but just as an example. You know, the average gang member, I think the average for a male in a gang these days lives to the average of age 25. You know, that's not natural. That's not right. And you think that the average person would like to live longer than that. So maybe the best way in the world for me to live past age 25 is to not join a gang. And yet they do. Because this appeal is real. Now, maybe your friends aren't trying to get you to go rob a bank. Maybe they're not trying to get you to deal drugs. But aren't we essentially in the same moral position when they're trying to get you to do anything that violates God's will? When they break down your resolve to oppose error, to shine your light in your community? Good friends are not going to do that. Those are friends that you don't want. Would a good friend ask you to accept their sin? And we'll read this one in Ephesians chapter 5. Again, I'm sure we've read it many, many times, but look at this with me. Put your eyes on the page. Ephesians chapter 5. And read verse number 11 and following. We're trying to learn what is pleasing to the Lord. That's our objective as Christians, right? That's what you're trying to do. That's why you're here today. Because you want to learn what is pleasing to the Lord. Verse number 10. Part of that is what he describes starting in verse number 11. Right? You looking at it? Do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead even expose them. For it is disgraceful even to speak of the things which are done by them in secret. But all things become visible when they are exposed by the light, for everything that becomes visible is light. Okay, what he's saying here is this. That your job as a Christian, your job as a light in the world, is to show people in darkness that they are in darkness. And what instead we oftentimes do, maybe unknowingly, maybe with full and perfect knowledge, we find ourselves joining them in the darkness and using whatever kind of rationalization we can come up with. Maybe it's not really all that dark. Maybe our association with them in the darkness will help drag them into light. You can convince yourself of anything you want when you really, really want to save a friendship. What Paul says is your job is to save their souls. And the first thing that you do in the preservation of somebody else's soul is to save yourself. Stay out of the darkness. And while you're out of the darkness, reach out as you can to the people who are in the darkness and try to pull them out of it. But by intentionally, deliberately, or passively, telling them that they're just fine in the darkness, you're not going to accomplish anything. And you may destroy yourself in the process. Real friends are not going to ask us to stay, to let them stay in their sin and applaud them for it. No relationship is going to be worth your soul. We have to be prepared to sever any of them, all of them, if necessary. Matthew chapter 10, verse 34, you know the text. You probably know all these texts that we've been referring to. Do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. We talked about Jesus being the Prince of Peace this morning. This isn't the kind of peace we're talking about. He didn't come into this world so that you could get along with everybody and make friends with everybody and have no ripples in your pond. He says, I came to set a man against his father and a daughter against her mother and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies will be the members of his household. And in that context, he says, he who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who does not love son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take up his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. He who has found his life will lose it, and he who has lost his life for my sake will find it. Do you want to be a Christian? Do you want to go to heaven when you die? That's what we're talking about here. Are you prepared to pay the price? If this is the price. Or have you already found your life? The one who has found his life, Jesus says here, the one who has settled, the one who has found the comfort zone, the things that make sense, the things that satisfy him, the things that scratch his itches. If that life is here, if that life is ultimately not what Jesus wants you to do with your life, realize that however happy that life is, however long it is, you can have 10,000 Facebook friends. Yep. You could have 500 people at your funeral. But there is going to come a day when you're going to have a funeral. That life is going to end. And then what are you going to do? Jesus says take the opposite approach. Lose your life here. Don't find your life. Lose it. Allow everything in it to be forfeit. Now, he won't make you give up all of it. He'll make you give up some of it. And you go along with that. You willingly surrender this life because you believe that Jesus is going to give you a better life in return. Understand, you cannot have both. It just doesn't work that way. If you have enough faith to believe in God, if you have enough faith to believe that he is a rewarder of those who seek him, Hebrews 11 verse 6, then you have to believe this, that prioritizing the things of this life, particularly at the expense of the things of the Lord, will cost you heaven. It is only the one who loses his life who ultimately is going to save it. And my lecturing is done on the subject. Only for today, anyway. Trust me, I'll come back to this later. But allow me to close with one final admonition. The things that draw you closer to the Lord, the things that draw you closer to heaven, closer to righteousness, these are the good things in life. As God defines good, these are the good people in life. These are the ones that you need to be associating with. The ones who make you laugh, the ones that make you feel good, the ones that tell you how wonderful you are, ones you make you a lot of money, whatever it is that they're doing for you. It's entirely possible, maybe even likely, that those people are hindering your quest for heaven. Please, whoever you are, young, old, in between, examine your relationships, examine your associations, examine your teachers, including this one, and be assured in your mind what really is the good morals that God wants for your life, and what really are the bad associations, the bad company that are hindering those good things. And make whatever change may be necessary in your life before it's too late, because it will come a time when it's too late, when you will not have the emotional, spiritual strength and courage
to make this tough call. You can make it today. Don't trust yourself to make it a year from now, 5 years from now. If you've decided to follow Jesus, then follow him. We're going to offer you an invitation to make that right. If that is not the case, if you have never followed him, if you have followed him and fallen astray, if you have not been the kind of example that you ought to be, we want to encourage you and lift you up because we are your friends. Because we love the Lord as much as you do. We want to help you on your way to heaven. Whatever we can do to assist you in that path, please allow us to do so while we stand and sing at this time.